You know what I'm going through? You think you know what Dwight Berry's going through? You don't know Jack!
Hello everybody and welcome back to the X-Cast. The truth is in here. I'm Tony Black, your host as ever, and this week we are covering one of the most seminal and classic X-Files ever committed to TV, Dwight Berry. And I am happy to be rejoined once again after the first episode of the season by Mr. Darren Mooney. Welcome back.
Pleasure to be back. Thank you for having me, Tony.
How have things been since we tackled Little Green Men?
Last we spoke, that's been great. I unfortunately broke my Blu-rays of the set of the second season, unfortunately, alas.
Oh no! How did that happen?
Catastrophe. There was a bus strike in Dublin, and as I was carrying them in my backpack, I happened to be accosted by whatever the collective noun for a group of cyclists is. A gaggle of cyclists? A cycle of cyclists?
We'll go with gaggle. Yeah, we'll go with gaggle.
Yeah, nothing like a bus strike to turn the city centre into a Darwinian nightmare. But one way or another, anyway, it fell, it broke. I'm very disheartened. It's a shame. It's a very good season of television. It's a shame that the Blu-rays were damaged. But on the upside, I did get a chance to watch these episodes in high definition for the first time, which was really something.
They look amazing, don't they? It's very true. Well, that is a shame. That is a shame. Maybe one day they will appear on UK Netflix in HD. So if you've got Netflix, then you might enjoy that. It's weird. Yeah. They've never come on UK Netflix. I don't understand why, really.
Yeah, they were on the US version for a while, I believe, wasn't it? I don't know if they had them in HD ever, because I remember when they were rolling out, when they first announced the remastering project, it was very much a big deal, but it was only for a specific market. So I think that, what's his name? Robert Rodriguez's network in the US, I think, were the first ones to air them in high definition. And I think that they were slow to roll out across streaming services, if I recall correctly.
I think they got there, because I remember... I did watch US Netflix for a time. say no more. But there was...
You're all tourists in our own way, Tony. We're all tourists in our own way.
Of course we are. That's the nicest way of putting it that won't get us in trouble with with the law. I think they were HD then. But it is a shame because Blu-ray, they really are extra special. You know, they really do amp up the crystallization of everything. So that's a shame. But yeah, this is if there's an episode to enjoy on Blu-ray from season two, I think Dwight Berry might be towards the top. So let's get straight into it and talk about the fifth episode of season two, Dwight Berry. Dwight Berry, as I say, is the fifth episode of the second season of The X-Files. It first aired on October the 14th, 1994, and was written and directed by Chris Carter for the very first... No, actually, I think this was the second time he'd done that. I think he did that with... No, it is the first time. I was going to say The Erlenmeyer Flask, but that was R.W. Goodwin. So I think this is the first time that Chris Carter wrote and directed an episode. You might be able to correct me on that, Darren.
No, it's his first time directing, and it will become sort of a regular feature. He generally direct at least one episode of every season going forward. I think the fourth season might be the exception, probably because he was so busy working on Millennium at the same time.
Yeah, quite possibly, and then gearing up for the movie and things like that. In this episode, the first of a two-parter, Mulder becomes involved in a hostage situation with an escaped psychiatric patient who claims to be terrified of frequent alien abductions.
His name's Dwight Berry. He's armed with a 9mm Smith & Wesson handgun, 1.9 round magazine. It is our belief that he's prepared to use the gun and not afraid to die.
What does he want?
Safe passage for himself and his original hostage, a shrink named Hackie.
Passage to where?
He's bent on taking the doctor with him to an alien abduction site, only he can't quite remember where the site is, so he stopped at a travel agency.
Is he lucid?
Yes, but he's off his medication, so he's manic. ranting about scoop mark scars on his body, homing devices, and a lot of other nonsense.
Like what?
This whole alien abduction business, which I guess you know something about.
Yeah, but I've never been in a hostage negotiation before.
Oh, we'll take you through it. Agent Rich is our advisory commander. He and I will be coaching you.
What Mr. Barry needs right now is a friend, someone who appears to understand him and can appeal to his sense of reason.
Do we know anything about his abduction experiences?
You really believe in this stuff, Agent Mulder?
Is that a problem?
Out of 10, then, Darren, where do you score Dwayne Barry?
Dwayne Barry gets an easy 8. In that, and being honest, and this is the problem I have grading a lot of the early second season episodes, is that I think if I were watching the show for the first time, it would be a continuous string of 10s as the sort of ceiling continues to rise. And I think that sort of going back over it, I don't want to say it diminishes it because you're still aware of how good it is. But there's a tendency to go, okay, well, look, I can't give them all 10s. So I have to maybe grade on a curve. And on the curve, which is a very good curve, this is an 8 for me.
Why would you not quite give it a 9 or a 10? Because a lot of people, and I would include myself, I would give it a strong 9. So why is it not quite as high for that for you?
I think, well, several reasons. The first reason is probably something we'll talk about when we get to Ascension, in that I have some issues with this two-parter. The second thing is I think that this is at the stage where the production team are still learning how to do things that they will do very, very well later on. And I think that when it comes to the mythology episodes in the second season, Dwayne Barry and Ascension sort of, they raise the level of what the show does a tremendous amount. But I think that there's a much bigger leap when you get later in the season with Colony and Endgame. Which are the first truly blockbuster X-Files episodes. I think that Ascension has some moments where it sort of comes very close, where it does like a Moonraker type thing that we'll talk about when we get there. But I think that the roof really comes off when you get to the final three mythology episodes of the season, so Colony, Endgame, and Anasazi. And I think Dwayne Barry is just shy of that. And it's not disparaging Dwayne Barry, and it's not diminishing it, because it is a fantastically tense psychological thriller episode, and it works very well with the characters. And I think Carter's direction, I think it's reasonable to have some criticisms of Carter as a writer, and I think they'll become sort of more obvious as we talk about later episodes. But I think Carter is horribly underrated as a director. I think he's a fantastic director, and I think that Dwayne Barry, you can already see, even though it's his first hour of television as a director, you can see the skill and the technique sort of shining through. So the problem is not necessarily that they're bad or that they're flawed in significant ways. It's just that they're not as good as I know the mythology episodes are going to be.
It's interesting you should say that, because I agree from a cinematic point of view. I think Colony and Endgame onwards are much stronger in that sense. This is Dwayne Barry especially, I think, and we will talk about Ascension obviously next time, but Dwayne Barry I think is the stronger of the two episodes.
Yeah.
Simply because it has that concept of arcing the whole thing around the hostage situation, while not completely being a traditional sort of story. You know, it doesn't last for the whole 40 minutes, and then you've got 10 minutes after that, and then obviously the massive cliffhanger. But I think there is a tendency. I think this is a fantastic script. I think it's very well directed, but there is a tendency to sort of put Dwayne Barry and Ascension, because it's connected, up there as like two of the best episodes of The X-Files. They are two of the most important episodes of The X-Files, without question, in terms of the story and the narrative. But whether or not they're two of the very best is open to debate. I would probably put Dwayne Barry in my top 25, definitely. But I don't know if it makes my top 10.
Yes, it would definitely not make my top 10. Maybe if you stretch to 30... or 40, I think you'd be sort of, that'll be the sort of range where I would see it fitting in there. And again, I'm not sure if I'd have difficulty ranking the two-parters sort of separately, because you're right that the thing about Dwayne Barry, and I think you'll probably talk about this later on, is that it was originally structured as own episode and extended out into a two-parter because of necessity. And it is very much, it has its own arc, as you said, with the hostage situation, which is a great, great hook of itself. But it's also, I think, so intertwined with Ascension that I think that diminishes it slightly. I think that Dwayne Barry would almost be a stronger episode if it were like, say, Fallen Angel or like EBE from the first season, where it was a one and done, and then we go back to regular business as usual, which is ironic because the reason it's important is because we don't go back to business as usual at the end of it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And as you say, as you suggested, that there were real life production reasons why Dwayne Barry ended up being two parts, and it went beyond the original one episode and done. So it's there's a lot with this where many people talk about this as the birth of the mythology, which I think to an extent it is, but I don't always agree with that, because I think it was Gillian Anderson's pregnancy forced them to make a course correction with season two. But I don't think at this point they knew exactly where everything was going, and Chris Carter had figured it all out in his head. I think it was these episodes were a reaction to the real life, you know, fact that Gillian wasn't available massively, and there were then elements later on which went back to the before this episode and started tying everything together, started connecting all the dots up. But I think, as I say, there is a tendency to make these two episodes almost so important to the show that they are raised up a bit too highly.
To almost mythologize them, if you will.
Quite possibly, yeah. Which maybe accounts for why on IMDb, out of 2,655 votes, it gets an 8.8 out of 10, which is one of the highest ratings on IMDb that you can get for The X-Files. So it's just, I think, stayed. It's one of the episodes, I think, from the show that has stayed even more than Ascension, but it has stayed in the pop culture, you know, in terms of X-Files. It stayed in the consciousness, Dwayne Barry. I think there are elements of this episode that many people who watch this show would remember quite vividly.
Yeah. And I think it's important to stress that the second season was really the show's coming out year. Like, I think in the first season, it was still a piece of cult television. And you still had people sort of sharing the videos online of episodes they'd missed and all this sort of stuff. I think while its cult grew over the summer, and then the second season was really when it grew the audience, it grabbed the attention of the audience. And you can sort of imagine they've had a phenomenal four episodes leading into this, and then this happens and it just sort of blows the roof off. Like, I can understand being an audience member in 1990, was it 95 or 96?
94, this.
94, wow.
Yeah.
So yeah, I can imagine being an audience member in 1994 and just having my expectations completely blown and having those images burned in my retina. Because I think, and again, we'll probably talk about this later on, this is the first episode where you actually get to see aliens.
Yeah.
Which it's impossible to overstate in terms of, like, The X-Files, how big a deal that is.
Yeah, exactly. And even though there is potentially more to that than it seems. As a visual standpoint, it is very, very, you know, crucial to the show, and it does stay with you, you know, and that goes down to, as you said earlier, Chris Carter's excellent direction on this, you know, and he really did do a great job, not just in terms of directing the actors and taking his script, but how he managed to craft the visuals that go into this, because there are some really disturbing and visceral visuals in this episode, more than I think many others in the show, especially tie into the idea of alien abduction. I don't think any episode in the series did alien abduction quite as scary as this.
It's sort of interesting that you should sort of say that, because when you look at how the show does alien abduction in episodes going forward, like, there's a lot of Dwayne Barry in that. So even, for example, in Jose Chung's From Outer Space, the alien abduction is very much its frame to recall Dwayne Barry. Or even in, say, the beginning of the eighth season, which has a very different look and feel in terms of texture and set design, there's still the drill. It still retains the drill imagery, which is this horrifying, as you said, visceral affecting imagery that just sort of makes you sit up and go, oh my God, what the hell's happening? So I think it endures for a very, very good reason. It's very, very powerful imagery.
Yeah, definitely. So let's get into the episode and discuss some more of that imagery and a lot more of the stuff, and let's talk about Dwayne Barry in more detail. So the episode begins with introducing Dwayne, and it's set in 1985, so it's a flashback. or maybe a prologue might be a better way of putting this. And we start with a star field, which I think is very an interesting first image. I think it very much sets up the idea of everything we're about to see over the next two episodes. And yeah. I think what struck me about the really interesting way Carter opens this episode by tracking his way through Dwayne Barry's house with the music of coming from the film and the noise coming from the film on the TV. I thought it was a really great way of underscoring how Dwayne Barry's life is very dark and depressing and
sad.
Sad, really.
The interesting thing about Carter's direction is that he chooses to open the show with what is the director's set piece. So it's very much there's a sequence later on where Carter very consciously and very slyly and probably motivated by budgetary concerns decides to cut away from what would on any other show be the big action set piece. But he opens with this long take of the camera weaving slowly and creepily through this. Well, on one hand, it's kind of creepy because it's very voyeuristic and it's this low down sort of creepy. What is moving through Dwayne's house? What are we seeing this from the perspective of? But it's also, as you said, it's like this man's life is a ruin. There's nothing left of it. He's living in this dilapidated house. He's watching a Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's court on the television. You know, he's hoping that he doesn't get another visitation in the late hours of the night.
Mm. Yeah, and you've got all of that imagery and all of that idea is visually there straight from the very beginning that we later obviously discover more about Dwayne and his situation. I was actually wondering about the film and what it was, A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. I don't know. Do you know much more about that film, Darren?
I don't actually know that much about the film. I got curious when I was watching it. I googled the language that we hear on screen, so the lines, which are, where is he, sire, etc., etc. And apparently it came back from a classic version of Mark Twain's story. And I think it's interesting. I wonder if that was a conscious choice or if it's the where is the king in the Great Hall, sire. But I think part of it was kind of curious. I assume there had to be a reason why Carter chose it beyond having the rights and maybe beyond even a personal preference for it. I sort of wonder, there's an argument he made that the novel A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court is one of the earliest American science fiction stories being written by Mark Twain. And so this intersection of science fiction and the great American novel or at least the classic American culture. And I sort of wonder if it's a sly statement on maybe what The X-Files is to Carter, in that it is in some ways a science fiction story. And it's about to get more of a science fiction story because we're about to see aliens. But it's also, I think it's a commentary on America, on sort of the country that Carter sees when he looks out the window. And I wonder if it's a sly sort of it is possible for something that is cheesy and something that has the trappings of genre fiction to actually be considered a great work or to be considered worthy or sort of dramatic or having merit in its own right.
Yeah, it could well be. I mean, I'm of the mind to believe that very little that he puts on screen in those kind of situations is coincidence. I think he would have thought through because we do see the TV at one point. Admittedly, it's partly a visual cue for the fact that the TV goes to static, which is one of the classic tropes of alien abduction and the aliens appearing in UFOs and things like that. But we do hear a lot of the dialogue. We do see that film. And, maybe that ties into the idea of Dwayne Barry as somebody who was very much the American family man, the working American family man before everything traumatic happened to him. And he lost it all, as we later discover. And that could also tie into it. Interestingly enough, his character wasn't originally called Dwayne Barry. He was originally supposed to be called Dwayne Gary.
Which is nowhere near as cool.
It's not. No, not at all.
I imagine it would get quite irritating hearing himself refer to himself as Dwayne Gary.
It
doesn't have the same sort of rhythm to it.
It doesn't sound right, does it? Apparently, staff researchers learned there was then a real FBI agent called Gary, surname. So they had to change it to Barry. Chris Carter didn't like it at first, but it grew on him, basically. And which is good, because as you say, Dwayne Gary just doesn't... And not even Gary with two R's. It's Gary.
Like a first name, like two first names. I suppose he has two first names as Dwayne Barry, but...
Yeah, Dwayne, maybe it's because we're used to Dwayne Barry, but I don't know. I don't think that would have worked the same. But yeah, this is the point. The static goes off, and that's when the abduction happens, or one of his abductions anyway. And we don't know anything about Dwayne Barry as a character yet. He's just a guy with a dog who lives on his own. And then suddenly, paralyzed in bed, bright shining light, alien figures who were actually children, who were hired to put on the bodysuits.
And stand around and look creepy.
Yeah, and stand around and creepily watch. And then Dwayne is just in bed, breathing heavily and shouting, "No, not again!" As suddenly he screams in absolute abject terror. And it has to be said right at the beginning, Steve Railsback is absolutely phenomenal as Dwayne Barry, isn't he?
He is. He's amazing. And I think, and it's funny to point to this as the first Carter, the first episode that Carter directed, because it sort of shows Carter originally, when he wanted to do the X-Files, he wanted to stay away from celebrity stunt casting or casting recognizable faces. Mm. So, like, casting Steve Railsback as Dwayne Barry, who is sort of, and even now he still works in these sort of B-movie, sort of grotty, maybe, sort of the kind of movies that if VHS still existed would be like, yeah, Video Nasties. And sort of seeing him brought in and made a focal point this episode, because it happens again when he does The List in season 3. The List in season 3 is like, it's like Chris Carter's like comedy roast, like all-star great lineup that includes like J.T. Walsh, who like only film critics recognize, but they love him.
Ken Foree. Great J.T. Yeah. Walsh, yeah.
Ken Foree, who's the guy from Dawn of the Dead. And it's just like, these are the characters, these are the actors that sort of that Carter chooses to put in his show. I think in particularly in the first 3 seasons, there's this wonderful cultivation of like very geeky, very niche, very sort of nerdy, very obscure sort of grotty B-movie character actors who do phenomenal work.
Yeah.
And Railsback is probably the best example of it, because he's the one you remember. Because of that wonderful tick of referring to himself in the third person, which...
Oh, that's amazing. It's the kind of thing that not everyone can get away with. And you have to... It could easily be cheesy or, you know, not work. But for Dwayne, it just fits completely. It's such a great tick. Chris Carter said that... he said, "I wrote the episode of Dwayne Barry for Steve Railsback. I've resisted casting the marquee names only because it takes you out of the show. It makes the show less believable, but there are certain actors who just call out for the part." And Railsback himself said, I like Dwayne Barry as a character. I always believed he was telling the truth, and he had it just up to here with not being believed. He hadn't seen the series, but he said, "The script is what excited me. It was written as well as any screenplay I'd ever read." And, you know, I mean, I always remember interviews and behind-the-scenes documentaries about The X-Files talking about how this was the first episode I think they ever showed on a big screen.
Oh.
As part of a festival or some kind of press tour thing back in the day. And it was this episode that Chris Carter said was the episode that made him realise they could do a movie. He said, "Watching Dwayne Barry on the big screen, I thought, we're making stuff here that is as good as most movies. Just in terms of the visuals and, you know, everything like that." And I think someone like Railsback got that.
I was going to say, just in terms of this being the first episode that was screened and Railsback liking the script, this was the first episode to be nominated for an Emmy for writing, wasn't it, if I remember correctly, for Carter's script. And also for CCH Pounder's guest appearance, which is she's great, but it's kind of strange that it's Pounder who gets the nomination for this and not Railsback.
It is odd. I mean, we'll talk about her a bit, but she is great. She is great. Yeah. But Railsback, really, it was odd that he didn't get a nod. Also, John S. Bartley got one for a nomination for cinematography as well.
Which, by the way, this looks absolutely beautiful. Like, it's got the same sort of... I love about the second season, particularly the early second season, watching it on Blu-ray, it has this wonderful blue-red look to it. So, like, when we were watching Little Green Men in the car park, it was all blue and red in the background. And obviously, later on, when they get to the travel agency, it's red and blue all in the windows. And it gives it this sort of eerie, otherworldly sort of not studio lit look to it.
Yeah,
and I think it works very, very well.
There's a certain element of grunge and, you know, darkness to it, which I think you wouldn't get. It would be hard to replicate now, strangely enough. It's one of the many things that draws you in with this episode. One thing just before we get out the teaser that struck me was, right from the beginning there, you know, all through the episode, there is a question of whether or not what Dwayne is seeing is accurate. And, you know, this is something that comes up later, especially when Scully comes into the picture. But the fact that they show us the UFO above Dwayne's house, and it's the first time we've seen a spherical UFO quite as, in this sense, quite as vividly as this, right in
the middle of the frame.
Someone's house. Yeah. In the middle of the frame, right above someone's house, blasting down a bright, you know what, like it's almost like the B-movie 50s kind of idea of alien abduction, isn't it? It's that classic sort of flying saucer and a beaming shine of light that will, you know, tractor beam you up into space.
That's it. You're waiting for the shot to continue with Dwayne being sucked up slowly to it, you know?
Exactly. And it made me think, well, it's interesting that Carter chose to put that in, because you could have had it end with Dwayne just screaming and the camera pulling away from him.
And that would have been enough.
That would have been enough, but he chooses to cut outside to the dog barking at the UFO, and we seeing the UFO. So straight away, much as all through the episode, there's an ambiguity as to exactly what is happening to Dwayne. I think he wants to point out that he is an alien abductee. Like there is no question of the fact he has been abducted by aliens. It's just when, how often, and who were they exactly? And I think that's really, really interesting. And all through these two episodes, I kept thinking about that.
Yeah, no, I think there's a version of this episode that could have been written that would have played it deliberately ambiguous. And I think it's good that Carter doesn't, because I think it's important here to establish. In the first season, there was always a sense of, like, you could let the show off the hook, like, Carter wasn't entirely committing to the possibility of aliens. That it, you know, it could be written that the fetus in the early modern flask was a genetic experimentation.
Yeah.
Or that they were super soldiers or something crazy like that with green blood. Ha, perish the thought. But, but with the first season, there was always a certain amount of hedging, I think, in what they showed. And one of the things I like about Dwayne Barry is that it's constructed so that it could support that hedging if Carter wanted. He could cut a couple of seconds here and there, and you could honestly have that ambiguity about whether Dwayne Barry is completely delusional or whether he is being abducted, and the show could continue on in that, oh, maybe it is, maybe it isn't, maybe Scully's actually right. Imagine a world where Scully's right. Whereas with Dwayne Barry...
Never.
Yeah, that's it. Dwayne Barry just goes, boom, there are aliens, and it runs with it. And I think when you talk about setting up the mythology... The way that Dwayne Barry actually features aliens and features the UFO means the rest of the mythology is actually free to run then with that.
Mm.
And I think that's important going forward. And I think that's the credit to Carter, that he sort of committed to that. For all the show gets flack, and I think it's become very fashionable to criticize, say, The X-Files for being too ambiguous and being sort of too loose with detail and sort of too hedging of its own bets and too willing to twist and turn and retcon and all this sort of stuff. I think that being willing to put that stuff up front in the fifth episode of the second season is something that it deserves a lot of credit for, and something that was quite risky at the time, but which paid off dividends.
Absolutely, yeah. And, you know, I mean, I've for many, many years, I was always one of these people who said, if you don't understand this show, you're just not paying enough attention. And I stand by that up until probably my struggle where he did retcon. And I had to at that point go, okay, fine.
Maybe. My own personal sort of and we're jumping way ahead here, but my own crazy sort of, I won't call it a jump the shark moment, because I kind of always suspected that Carter was improvising is probably, or jazz. He saw it as jazz rather than sheet music. Was when he hit the seventh season, he revealed the fate of Samantha. And I'm sitting there watching. I was watching it the first time I saw it, and I was like, there is no way that he sat down when he was plotting the X-Files and said, this is how I see this story ending. And I think that Carter, to his credit, and it works very well in the second season and the third season, and begins to hit a bit of a sand dune in the fourth season, is he's got this wonderful knack for improvisation and going with, okay, well, this aspect, this thread interests me, so I'll unravel it and pull it. And it's when you've after he's unraveled everything and then has to reassemble it into something resembling like a sweater, that's when the X-Files runs into bother.
It's true. He is very good. He is very, very good at improvisation. And admittedly, the show very often got away with it by going, oh, well, it's the X-Files, it's nebulous, you're not quite supposed to know, you know, and that was sometimes, there was an element of, well, we've just made it up as we go along. But it's fine, in general.
Yeah. I think I'd argue this is an example of improvisation working very well, where it's like, oh my God, Gillian Anderson's pregnant, well, what the hell do we do?
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, well, we'll turn in this episode, or we'll turn in this two-parter. I think so, you know, improvisation does work very well. I think Dwayne Barry and Ascension are, you know, a credit to that, or, you know, sort of a,
yeah.
an example of that.
So we're finally out of the teaser, and we're still with Dwayne. We haven't got to Mulder and Scully yet, and we see him having in the medical facility, and we're in the present day now, so we've jumped forward 9 years, and he has a meeting with the extremely gaunt Dr. Hackey.
Looks a lot like James Cromwell.
He does, but James Cromwell, I don't think I've ever seen a man as thin as Dr. Hackey in my life. It's like, wow, scarily thin, scarily gaunt. And a doctor who doesn't take Dwayne seriously. You know, Dwayne saying, I'm not crazy, but he's not taking his meds. But Hackey doesn't want to know.
Who doesn't take Dwayne seriously, but is also like, oh, don't worry, leave me alone with this former FBI agent who I believe to be mentally unstable. Like, there's the wonderful moment where the guard lets him in, and the guard is kind of like, should I stay? And Hackey's like, no, I'll be grand. It'll be fine.
It's fine.
Yeah, I'll just turn my back on him while I dope him up. It'll be fine.
His hands are restrained. What can happen? Where's the harm?
Yeah.
I think right from the beginning, though, because Dwayne's talking about how he doesn't like the meds, and you know he can feel them coming back.
Yeah.
I think one of the things I always thought from the beginning was Dwayne is being, I think, controlled right from the beginning to some extent. I think there's some sort of imperative. And, you know, if you go deeper into mythology and of what they later, you know, created, there's the whole idea that his implants have an element of control built into them that remotely. And I think when he feels that they're coming, I think there's an element of...
Somebody flicked a switch somewhere.
Yeah, basically. And this is what triggers him to, you know, get the gun, knock out Hackey in a hilarious way that you blatantly didn't knock him out.
It's very much a William Shatner sort of blow, isn't it? Because he got his hands together. It's like, boom.
Yeah, doesn't work. it's that imperative, I think, which compels him to escape. And I don't think for a minute we're at the point where this is all being programmed to get Scully out of the way. Because I think that's too much of a leap. But I think there is an element of that Dwayne is being controlled for some end.
I was going to say, if it's not like a long game involving Scully... Because it's very much structured in a way, because the final scene of Sleepless is like, oh, don't worry, we'll take care of that.
Yeah.
And then you sort of seek into, oh, Dwayne Barry is having this crazy psychic episode where he thinks the aliens are coming to get him. I wonder why somebody would flick that particular switch, if not with something like that in mind. Although that said, it is an incredibly convoluted leap of logic to go, oh, don't worry, he'll escape, then he'll hold up a traffic thing, and then he'll go and get Scully. And presumably, does he track Scully down because she has the implant? Is that how he's able to find her? Because I think in Ascension, Mulder suggests that he was given her address or whatever. So part of me sort of wonders, if he hadn't have held up the travel agency, would he have been driven to go to get Scully straight away? Or was it in some way as a result of the implant and then somebody being like, oh, wait, we can improvise and use this. It'll, you know, funny you should mention this. Funny Scully happens to have this thing that we want. And there's a lunatic on the loose, and we want Scully abducted. We'd be fools not to do this.
Exactly, yeah. It could be the simple fact that it's such a convoluted and crazy plan that's the whole idea, you know, in that it's so convoluted that nobody would even dream of it.
Yeah. That's how the conspiracy works, you know. You think it's crazy. That's the defense, you know. If you say it out loud and explain it, of course it sounds crazy.
Yeah, but anyway, Dwayne's out. And he's taken Dr. Hackey hostage. And then we get the sequence that has sent a million fangirls and fanboys, frankly, into paroxysms of excitement for many years. It's David Duchovny in his Speedos.
No, it's Krycek watching David Duchovny in his Speedos as well.
That's true. Yeah. How long was he there watching him swim?
Yeah.
Just another lap. Just one more. There has probably been countless... you know, fan fiction, slash fiction written about what happened after beginning, that scene.
Yeah, beginning with that. Krycek, why are you following me into the dressing room? Oh, it's very important that I bring you completely up to speed. Don't worry on my account.
Yeah, and don't worry about this oil in my hand, you know.
You look very tense, Mulder. You look very tense. This will help you relax. Don't worry, I'm going to continue delivering exposition while we're doing this, just so you don't feel uncomfortable. I honestly have a hard time believing that when the writers wrote that scene and when Carter shot that scene, that he wasn't aiming rather deliberately for that particular place. Because one of the things about Krycek's characterization in the early second season, he's very clearly positioned as a rival to Scully. And part of that is down to the intimacy that Scully shares with Mulder. So I would not be surprised if, you know, this was a sly wink and a nod to that. And again, later on in Ascension, and we're sort of getting into spoiler territory here, but the way Mulder figures out that Krycek is not on the level is it's like a cheating spouse. He finds something, he finds cigarettes where there shouldn't be cigarettes, you know?
That's true.
So I think that's a very conscious sort of framing of Krycek as the other woman almost, which is interesting.
It is interesting, and it's also interesting that all through this episode, and part of Ascension as well, there is, but especially in this episode, Krycek's there. He doesn't have a massive role in everything, but he's there. But we now know, unlike Sleepless, where he seemed to be the quite green, you know, eager to please FBI newbie.
Yeah.
We now know, of course, that he's more than that. We don't quite know who or where, what he is or where he's come from, but he's one of the Smoking Men's boys. So we go through all this with a very much, you look at Krycek in a different way, because there's barely any suggestion of that throughout this episode, but it's there now. So you'll have to kind of interpret his, you know, him acting actions very much through as Mulder's partner, as a role he's playing.
One of the things I really like about Krycek in Dwayne Barry and Ascension, and as you said, it only works because you know that he's the cigarette-smoking man's lackey, is you get this wonderful sense from Nick Lee that all of this is so far beneath him. Like, there's this recurring sense in both Dwayne Barry and Ascension that Krycek is sort of looking at what's happening and going, why the hell am I doing this?
Like, Especially in Ascension,
Well, I mean, no, even in Dwayne Barry, when it's like when he's asked to order coffee, he's like, dude, I kill people for a living. You know, I cover up an alien conspiracy. I don't worry about wanting your 2% mocha.
Yeah, it's true. And I mean, that is obviously played for laughs, but there is that underlying idea that nobody quite knows the truth about this guy. And it's something that we're in on it. We're a step ahead of Mulder, even more than usual.
Yeah.
You know, normally we don't even get to see the conspiracy side of things. You know, in the past we haven't. You know, we've been almost as in the dark as Mulder. But in this case, we know something he doesn't at this point. And it's an interesting, it's the first time the show has ever really done this. And it just adds that extra dimension to an episode that is a fairly traditional story throughout the majority of it, really, with the added element of Mulder and bringing a lot of his own personal baggage to everything and personal emotion to everything.
What's interesting about that, when you talk about this being a very typical episode of television, I think it's true of both Dwayne Barry and Ascension, is that these could very easily be episodes of something that isn't The X-Files. In that the first episode, Dwayne Barry, is very much, it's a hostage situation, which is a tried and tested sort of staple of, you could almost do it on NYPD Blue or Hill Street Blues or something like that, or Miami Vice. And the second one is like, it's another hostage situation, except this time it's on the run. And you could also, you could imagine that working on, you know, something like Hill Street Blues or something like NYPD Blue. And I think it's very interesting to see the X-Files sort of filter that through its own particular lens, where it's like, okay, this crazy person has taken a bunch of people hostage, but what if they're not really crazy? I think that's a very clever twist. And a part of me suspects that maybe why this episode was sort of singled out by Emmy voters, because it's halfway between the craziness that The X-Files does so well and something that's much more conventionally sort of familiar prestige television in 1994.
Yeah, or alternatively, it could have been a movie idea. You know,
yeah, that's it exactly.
Which you know, you put this guy into a situation where it seems to be traditional, and maybe this seemingly crazy guy is telling the truth, as you say. So it has a lot of extra stuff to it there. So they go to the hostage situation at Travel Time Travel Agency, where we meet Agent Lucy Kasdan, played by CCH Pounder, as we mentioned before, who, as we say, got nominated for an Emmy and gives a great performance. And I think the reason that she does is and makes Kasdan so memorable, partly because she's a good actress anyway.
She's phenomenal.
But yeah, a really great actress, really great character actress. But what she does with Kasdan, and it is, to be fair, it's in the writing, but she punches it up a little bit extra. But Kasdan has a really interesting arc of somebody who is a traditional hostage negotiator, you know, at the head of it, like a special agent in charge of these kind of things. She's done this many times. She knows the script. She knows the routine. Mulder comes in. He's told exactly, this is how it works. This is what this guy's about. You're basically here to, you know, read the script. You're here to because you're from a kooky sort of area, and this guy's talking about kooky things without alien abduction, we're getting you in, you can talk to him, we'll get everything ready, you follow it, it'll all be fine. But all through the episode then, especially by the end, Kasdan kind of realises there was more to this. And by the time we get to that final scene where she tells Mulder about the fact that Dwayne does have implants. It's she plays it brilliantly because there's a little look on her face as if to say,
what is this?
What the fuck?
You were right. Maybe you were right.
Yeah. What? And you know, that's it. You don't see her again. But and she doesn't figure into the mythology or anything. But it's a really nice little arc.
This is something the X-Files returns to a couple of times, is this idea of a character who gets drawn in. And it happens in the mythology a couple of times as well, where a character who is doing their job, and it's particularly evident in, say, the plane crash two-parter in the late fourth season, was a Tempest Fugitive Max, where yes. There's a guy, Mark Miller, who is like, he's the flight correspondent, and this is his job, and he knows what he's doing, and Mulder and Scully have been drafted in to help. And, you know, whatever craziness you need to believe it, just get the job done. But over the course of the two-parter, he has the same arc of sort of Kasdan, where he's exposed to these incredible things, and he comes to believe in some small way, or to accept that the world is more than what he thought it was. Which in some ways is arguably Skinner's arc as well. Which is odd. Yeah. I think it's a very... Like the X-Files, we talked about this maybe before when we were talking about Little Green Men, about the X-Files being sort of cynical or optimistic. There's this recurring theme that, like, if the average person is confronted with something like this, there is as much chance of them not accepting it maybe, but embracing it or understanding it or being curious about it. That maybe the world isn't as dark as Mulder thinks it is. Maybe people aren't as cynical or disillusioned as he thinks it is. Like he says himself when Kasdan calls him in, I thought you were going to chew me out. Kasdan's like, no, you did your job. And I think that's a weirdly optimistic moment when we think of the X-Files as a show about paranoia and mistrust. It's like, no, actually, if you confront people with something unusual and strange, maybe they can handle it. Maybe they're not all lying or conspiring or sort of involved in this work to sort of to ridicule what you're doing. I don't know. I thought that was quite nice.
It's interesting because I bring this up because there's a sort of similarity in terms of that idea. And I've been watching a great deal of Smallville lately, the Clark Kent series, which it feels in some respects like a spiritual sequel in some ways to the X-Files because it's filmed in Vancouver. It's got a lot of the same actors.
It has Mark Snow's score, doesn't it?
It has Mark Snow's score, and he uses so many of the same music beats. it sounds a lot like the X-Files. But, you know, the underlying theme, certainly in the first three seasons of Smallville, which I've watched, is that Clark has all these people around him, and he can't tell many of them the truth about who he is and where he's from. And the question keeps coming up, especially with, you know, Lana Lang, who he's in love with and things like this, is... You know, the responsibility of knowing these things and believe and knowing who I am and what I am, especially when I don't understand it myself fully, is huge. And can I give someone that responsibility? Can I trust anybody to have that? And then quite often, I'm sitting there watching it, shouting at the screen, going, just tell them, because they'll be okay. They'll be able to deal with this. You're creating more problems because you're not telling people who you trust the truth. And it's... With the X-Files, there was a real, I think, one of the big appealing things about the show was when you had characters like Kasdan, like Mark Miller, as you said, and there are more, who realise there's this whole world behind the curtain. And when you start to see them realise that, it's very, very appealing for a viewer because you feel like it could happen to you, I think. That's kind of the way I've always approached it. It's kind of, they're often quite human, normal characters. You know, especially Mark Miller, he's a great example. And Tempest Fugit and Max is a great two-part episode. It's really, really good for the most part. And he's a great character because he's a normal guy. And at the first, he's very, and we will get to this obviously in a few years, but he's very disparaging of Mulder and who he is at the beginning. So yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting about Kasdan and, you know, the way she, the way her art goes throughout this episode. But yeah, we're in the middle of the hostage situation and Mulder's reading from the script, you know, and he's basically, they all think he's a little bit crazy when he basically turns around and says, I believe in this stuff, sorry, but... And then I love the fact he immediately just goes off book when he's talking to Dwayne, especially when he realises that Dwayne is more knows of the script, because Dwayne quotes it back to him.
Is there one I'm forgetting?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. And he's like, who is this guy? You know? And he realizes that he hasn't been quite told everything. So there's a nice level of, you know, bureau politics going on here, where they're basically trying to mitigate embarrassment for the fact that Dwayne used to be an FBI agent. And this is where we find out, basically, that he used to be an FBI agent. Which is interesting, isn't it? Because I immediately thought, this is the guy Mulder could end up being, couldn't it, really? If it all goes wrong.
If it all goes wrong, living alone, forgotten. Like, we don't find out exactly what happened to Dwayne in terms of his official record drummed out. I think Kasdan says he was shot in the head using his own firearm during a drug stakeout that went wrong, which is a very strange sequence of events. One imagines that, you know, you would want to know more about how that came to be. But you do get the sense that, yes, he's this guy who everybody thinks is crazy and who's ended up sort of shut off and forgotten. And you get to the point where, yeah, Mulder locked away in the basement is, before Scully arrived, was he that far removed from this? You know, was he that far away from a nervous breakdown or something that will push him over the edge like this? One of the things I actually really like about this, and it's mostly down to Carter's writing and direction, is you're talking a bit about how Carter as a director sort of communicates everything you need to know very clearly. There's this recurring sort of theme or suggestion, it's mostly told through visual cues as opposed to dialogue, that connects Dwayne Barry's abduction to the FBI trying to manage the situation. So, for example, you have a sequence where it cuts from the drill going into Dwayne Barry's mouth to the drill drilling into the wall so they can have the shot at Barry. Or you have the bit that cuts from Dwayne Barry on the table surrounded by aliens to the FBI agents surrounding a similar table, which is very nice. It's a very nice visual cue. But I think it also underscores the idea that maybe, like, Dwayne was not just abused and neglected by aliens, that he was sort of thrown out by the system, that the same people who are involved in the standoff at the moment, maybe not the same literal people, but the organizations, are in some way responsible for the man that he became, or sort of the breakdown that he had, or the loss that he suffered, which I think is very clever. It's sort of...
No, it is. It is a very interesting way of looking at that. And it is left open to interpretation, really, because like you say, you know, Kasdan says that what happened to him is something of a mystery, and it's a mystery that's never specifically, you know, explained. So it's interesting in that sense, yeah. And I think it was a nice way to get Scully into the story with Mulder, you know, calling her and saying, find out a bit more about this dude. Find out who he is. You know, it's a good way, even though obviously Gillian Anderson's screen time is limited, it's good to know she's still involved and she's still there and she's still, you know, connected to the story.
And it's funny because we were talking about this, I think, in relation to Little Green Men, where we were talking about how Mulder needs Scully to ground him. And I think even in Dwayne Barry, there's a great example of that. Because, like, the one thing Kasdan says to Mulder is do not under any circumstances begin to buy into his delusions, because then he won't negotiate with you. And what does Mulder immediately do? He buys into the delusion. And then it takes Scully coming along, being rational and calm, to point out that actually, yes, Dwayne Barry is not who Mulder thinks he is. Like, he's mentally unbalanced, he's unreliable, he's violent. And you get the sense that maybe... Okay, being honest, if Mulder and Scully were still partners, Mulder probably still would have gone in there and still would have bought into the delusions. But you get a sense that Scully probably would have been able to manage him a little bit better.
Yeah, because that's the thing, isn't it? You know, after we get the mysterious buzz of the what could be a UFO, what could be a helicopter, the suggestion that people are messing with Dwayne, or possibly are trying to enhance the situation in terms of the I thought that when that moment is there, when the light buzzes, it's sort of the trigger to get Dwayne to shoot someone, to go a little bit over the edge, to push him over the edge, So it forces Mulder's hand a little bit more, really.
And I like the ambiguity of it, actually. You know, despite the fact we're saying it's good that there are actually aliens and UFOs in this, I like that is kind of like, is somebody trying to push the situation to a head, trying to get him on the edge, trying to escalate it, as opposed to a bunch of aliens just showing up and nothing happening.
Well, this is it all the way through the episode. After that teaser, all the way through this and Ascension, there is no direct sort of evidence that it is aliens. You know, never again. It is very ambiguous. It's only at the very beginning, historically, when we see that Dwayne was abducted, is the only point where they say that was aliens. Every other time, it might not have been. And that's what's interesting, because there is that underlying government element to the whole thing. And so, obviously, this triggers Mulder going in.
Oh, yeah, the hostage who gets shot in, who's like the rudest hostage ever, so you don't particularly care. He's the hostage who's introduced saying, do we have to sit on the floor all night? You're like, dude, in this situation, sitting on the floor, maybe not your biggest concern.
It's not the biggest worry, really.
Although what I did like
about the hostages was that there was a little bit of, there was a little bit of character to some of them. So there was that guy who was a bit bullish. There was the afraid middle-aged woman. And then the girl who's terrified and can't help the guy when he's shot. But then at the end, in that lovely little moment, that brilliant little moment, stops at Dwayne and says, I believe you.
Yeah, no, I think it's lovely.
Yeah, it's really good because, she, you know, he's put her through a real ordeal and, you know, he shot her boss. But whatever, everything she heard him talking to Mulder about, which we now see, is enough to make her go, well, this guy, nobody could do this and fake it that much. You know, he's clearly gone through something. But this is the core bit now. After Mulder gets his earpiece placed in by Stephen E. Miller, who later would go on to play Andy McLaren in Millennium.
And he played a tackle shop owner in I Want to Believe as well. He's one of those 10-13 regulars. Along with Pounder. Pounder also had a recurring role in Millennium as well.
Yes, she did.
It's like you get a sense that sort of Carter met a bunch of people on this set who he really liked to work with and just kept working with them.
He got a bit of a rep going, didn't he, with recurring actors, which is really nice. Yeah. But yeah, he gets the tech put in his ear, which was at that point not real. That didn't actually exist. Yeah. At that point, that didn't actually exist. It was fictional, but similar ideas for it now exist, or an equivalent now exists. So yeah,
the technology or just the idea for it?
I'm not 100% sure. I think possibly, or it probably is in this day and age with, you know, the way phones work and the fact and wireless headphones and things like that. I'm sure it is doable now, but back then, yeah, it was fictional.
There's a moment where sort of Dwayne's leaning in on him and I'm sort of wondering how he didn't notice the earpiece or the little tiny earpiece.
Well, because he's very close to him, isn't he?
Yeah, it's a very intimate, sort of intense scene. And it's framed in a way that he's looking practically at the side of Mulder's face.
How do you miss that?
Maybe there really wasn't that much ominous about him getting shot with his own firearm during a drug stakeout.
Yeah.
I'm just throwing it out there.
But this is the core central bit of the episode now. And you know, there are some other things going on. You do have Scully finding out that, you know, Dwayne Barry may not be who Mulder thinks he is, but we'll get to that. The core of the episode is now this conversation between Mulder and Dwayne, where Mulder's in the middle of the hostage situation. He's tied up and they have this incredibly intense conversation, which is divided by really sort of equally intense flashbacks with massive epileptic lighting. I mean, strobe lighting, but my point was epileptics look away because it's really, really intense. Of the flashbacks of Dwayne remembering everything that happened to him when he's lifted off the bed and all the alien abduction tropes leading up to the whole thing, as you mentioned before, where his teeth are drilled. And it's phenomenal. I mean, all this stuff with Mulder and him is brilliant. I mean, it's acted spot. I mean, Duchovny's one of Duchovny's best performances, probably, this.
It is. And there's this wonderful psychological sort of tug of war between the two of them, where it's like, is one of them going to break or blink? Like, is Mulder going to say something that will set Dwayne off, or is Dwayne going to say something that Mulder will realize that Mulder will suddenly decide that he's faking it, or he's making it up? Like, there's the wonderful sequence where they have the laser sight on Dwayne, and Mulder calls him over to talk to him. It's like as if Mulder didn't call him over, the whole situation would be resolved.
Exactly.
And it's sort of like, is Mulder putting these people, these other hostages, in danger to get the answers that he wants? Like, is Mulder so determined to find an answer through Dwayne that he would risk the lives of, say, the hostages or the whole situation, or even Dwayne's life himself, I suppose?
Well, it's interesting because it's a question I was asking myself. At the beginning, he seems to be, and there are points where, and crucially, it's when Scully actually comes through on the mic that he sort of snaps back into being an FBI agent and remembering why he's there. But there is a point where he gets so into asking Dwayne these questions, you know, was there a ship? Did they take you on a ship? What happened? And he is, to some extent, playing a role. It's like Kasdan warns him, you know, you're playing a dangerous course here, because she knows he's trying to goad Dwayne into this. But at the same time, I think Mulder was getting a bit lost. You know, he's getting a bit caught up in this whole thing because he's desperate to feel this kinship with Dwayne. And I think it takes Scully to come in on the mic and go, by the way, he might be a complete fantasist. He had this thing happen to him when he got shot that basically destroyed the moral center of his brain. Be careful. Don't trust him. It might all be a load of a pack of lies.
Yeah. Which is very much like the perfect Mulder and Scully moment. I think it's great about the early second season because you do have this sense of Mulder being slightly lost without Scully when she's like arm's breadth away. And then like after the two-parter, you see what happens when Scully's completely away. Mulder goes a little bit off the rails.
Yeah.
And I think that so there's a sense of like the X-Files has been taken away from Mulder. He does, I wouldn't describe it as a death wish, but he has like he seems broken. And I think this is a great example of that. Like, I think that he has nothing to tether him. I think that during the hostage scenes, a lot of the tension comes from the audience asking, like, how far would Mulder go? Like, you get the sense watching it, Mulder would almost put himself in a car with Dwayne and drive to wherever Dwayne wants to go and try just because it would give him the chance to see it for himself.
Yeah.
Which is not what you want from a hostage here.
No.
They tend to frown on that, I think. it's not on the board. It's not on the little board that sort of Kasdan has.
Yeah. It's not on her list of things.
Four points.
Yeah, the 4 points. Reconciliation
and road trips.
Yeah. Yeah, that's point number 5, road trips. It is a really interesting idea that maybe he would go down this rabbit hole with him. And I think their relationship changes. At first, Dwayne is angry and he's having these horrible flashbacks and he's going a bit wild. But then by the end, at the point where Mulder finds out from Scully that Dwayne may not be what he seems, Mulder and Dwayne are having this kind of quite friendly, relaxed chat almost, aren't they?
I mean, if you can't bond over alien abduction, I mean, you know.
Yeah. Well, yeah, what can you
I mean, like, if Mulder was ever gonna form a lasting friendship, this would be, like, top of the common interest, sort of.
Yeah. But this is where Dwayne talks about the government for the first time, because everything else has been describing what happened to him, you know, that he's had implants put in him and drilling holes, and we see it, although we see what he remembers, which isn't necessarily the truth, although later on it seems to be suggesting that it is the truth. But in this, he basically talks about a secret corporation. There's an interesting moment. I don't know if it's just Railsback playing it a certain way, but he says it as if to say a secret corporation, and he rubs his head as if to say he knows the name. It was almost like Dwayne knows more, but he can't quite remember. And I thought that was really interesting. You know, then there's the flashback to seeing the men in black in his home instead of aliens. And then the question is, well, were there ever aliens to begin with? At this point, even though we saw the UFO, which suggests there were there at times when Dwayne was taken by men, by this corporation.
This comes back in Ascension, where there's another moment where Dwayne has a moment where he sees the men in black, and you're asked to wonder, is this aliens or is this people? Is this the government?
Exactly. You are left wondering, really, quite where you stand on that in terms of how he's feeling and how he's thinking. So you've got some fantastic direction with the scenes with, you know, and set design as well. And, you know, for the whole, when Dwayne is captured, the whole set design of the drill, it's all very sort of organic, angular, sort of cold alien technology that's brilliantly put together. It's very arcane. It's so alien. It's very alien. That's what I liked about that so much.
Yeah, it's kind of strange when the show's budget increases. So like at the start of like the 8th season, they have a much different sort of more organic alien design. I almost like the sparseness of just the black and white contrast and the empty space.
Yeah.
And the lighting of this alien space, where you get the sense, like, you've no idea how big the room is, or you've no idea if there's anything beyond what's happening to Dwayne. Like, this could be a small section on a massive hangar, or this could be a tiny room. You've got no sense of, you don't even know if there's a floor beneath him, which is interesting, you know?
It's the minimalism, which is really effective. There is that. You've also got Mark Snow's music is also really good throughout this. It's really sort of thick and dark and creeping, really, I think. It really captures the tension of the whole situation brilliantly. I think he does a really great job here throughout. So you've just got all these elements that build up to being a real cocktail that make these, coupled with the great writing and the really good performances, make this whole hostage situation really, really good and really intense, while speaking to Mulder's own obsessions and paranoias and everything like that. It's just a really great combination and a cocktail. And then you might think that the episode would end with the end of that hostage situation, but no.
Well, I love the way that Carter does end the hostage situation in a manner that you don't quite expect by just cutting to black and having the sound play over it. Which I'm not sure if it was for budget reasons or because they didn't have time to do it or because of the stunt coordination or something like that. But it's an interesting directorial choice because it gives you a sense of the chaos that's unfolding without actually showing you it, which is it emphasizes that maybe the hostage situation isn't the focal point of the plot.
I think it was a budgetary thing, the cut to black. But ultimately, it helps. You know, it makes it... Yeah. You don't really need to see all that stuff. You know, just by having it cut to black and then... You know,
you can watch a CSI episode.
Yeah, exactly. It's wasted minutes, really.
Yeah.
When you could be getting on to what happens afterwards, which is even more interesting. You know, you get the scenes where Kasdan, as we talked about, speaks to Mulder about it all and points out that there were implants in Dwayne's sinus and everything like this. And then obviously Mulder gets hold of one and takes it to Scully. And they're wondering, you know, what this means. And Scully gets it checked out, which... There's some really interesting things here. The first thing is that she sees that some kind of serial code on there, which later at the very end she suggests is an indication of cataloging, which is something that comes up towards the end of the second season and the start of the third. So there's already that idea in Chris Carter's mind that people, abductees, are potentially being cataloged in some way, and there's like a VIN number on all of them through their implants.
That's it. It looks like a barcode.
Yeah, exactly.
And that leads to the scene at the store. Yeah. As well, which is brilliant. It's like, I know I brought it to an expert FBI agent who specializes in doing this sort of thing, but you know, it sort of looks like a barcode. So I wonder what happens if I run it over a device.
Yeah.
And I love the sort of the not guilty sort of, what happened? Oh, no idea. Nothing happened. I don't know what's going on here. Excuse me. I
don't know what happened.
Yeah. I didn't notice there was anything wrong. Yeah. I thought those loud sirens were meant to be going off.
As the computer is having a complete meltdown because it can't handle the sheer complexity of whatever that thing is. Did they ever manage to shut that computer down, or did it just carry on forever?
I like the idea of the local grocery store just having this crazy computer in the corner that is screeching and screaming. And they're like, occasionally it gives us lottery numbers. But no, because I like, and you're talking about how this comes up, sort of the VIN numbers and the commercialization of people. And how it comes up again at the end of the second season. It's interesting to sort of like this sense of the conspiracy as something that does almost reduce like people to chattel and people to sort of to items and objects to be commodified and human bodies to commercial entities. Kind of like this grotesque capitalism sort of thing, like the use of freight trains later in the season. So that, which is obviously it's a shout out to some very dark things that happened in Europe in the middle of the 20th century. But it's also... an indication that maybe these people are being commodified and they are being sort of exploited and treated as an object. And I think that the barcode and the supermarket scene are a really great way to communicate that without actually coming out and saying it. And I think Carter gets a lot of flack for his purple prose dialogue, and deservedly in some cases.
Yeah.
But I think Dwayne Barry does an excellent job of like communicating that stuff in a way without actually saying it through... And maybe it's because Carter was directing that he felt comfortable sort of doing it. But it happens a lot in the X-Files where you do have, like, you have these ideas that are communicated through visuals or through, like, suggestions or through ellipses rather than exposition. And I think that's a great example of that.
Yeah, I think that's true. This episode gets that balance really well, I think. And you know, it manages to keep all that stuff. There's a hell of a lot in this script, you know. There's a hell of a lot of ideas and... you know, character moments and story, you know, which obviously is where we build to the climax, the first true cliffhanger the X-Files has ever really done, which is stormy night, ominous, Scully with the chip, confused, really worried. She thinks there's you know, she's freaked out by the computer thing. She mentions the cataloging, and then suddenly a strange sound at the window. Open the blinds, crack a thunder, Dwayne Barry's face, To be continued, and then shouting down the phone, going, Mulder! Like that. And I'd tell you what, this isn't the cliffhanger that gives me chills. The cliffhanger that gives me chills comes at the end of Colony. But this cliffhanger is, like, great, because it ends it on a complete... I mean, I'd love to have been watching it when it first aired, like, live. But, I mean, I did see it fairly soon after that. but I knew elements of what was coming afterwards because I'd seen episodes out of order. But I'd love to have been watching this and having no idea about Gillian Anderson and, you know, the production side of it, and then seeing this cliffhanger and going, what? You know, yeah. Because at this point, you don't really know what Dwayne Barry's going to do. It makes sense in the fact that, and this is the question I had, was it at the point when Scully got this implant that when they maybe were done with Dwayne or whatever the plan was with Dwayne had either worked or hadn't worked, and then suddenly they flick the switch again, he wakes up in hospital, knocks out the guy.
By the way, and... yeah, the worst security in the world. Like, it seems like yeah. It seems like wherever anybody's ever keeping Dwayne Barry, it's wherever they send sort of the people who fail the security exam.
Yeah.
And Carter, we're talking about little callbacks to this stuff. Carter uses this pretty much the exact same sequence at the start of an episode of Millennium, Lamentation, where another security guard in a hospital gets bludgeoned with a fire extinguisher. Yeah. You'll get the sense that almost fire safety in hospitals is dangerous in the world of the X-Files of the Millennium.
Yeah.
You're really just giving psychopaths bludgeons.
They're like the red shirts, these people, aren't they, from Star Trek of the X-Files.
Yeah, make sure you only have one guard standing on duty and make sure he's easily distracted.
Yeah. I mean, he really, really wallops this guy with the fire extinguisher. I mean, I thought if that hasn't killed him, I'll be amazed, because that was a proper wallop.
Yeah, Dwayne Barry doesn't do things by half measures.
No, he clearly doesn't. But you see, this is what made me think, was at that point the switch was flicked and he was subconsciously programmed, get Scully. This is why I don't necessarily think it was the plan from the beginning. I think it was only when she got that implant and, you know, coupled with the fact that they needed to do something about Scully. But I think they saw this as an opportunity and they were like, well, for a start, she's got technology that could really prove this or really lead to things we don't want her to find. So it's ambiguous, and whether it's the case or not is uncertain, but I think there's a definite argument for the implant is what gets Scully abducted.
I do like the image, though, that you've sort of given me, the mental image of the cigarette-smoking man just sort of sitting there at the end of a meeting going, I love it when a plan comes together.
Yeah. With a cigar in his mouth, like Hannibal
Smith.
With
a cigar instead of a cigarette, yeah.
Yeah. I love it when a plan comes together. Yeah. Now we've got an alternate world where George Peppard played the cigarette smoking man. that would have been great.
Do we live in the best of all possible worlds? It is important to ask.
So yeah, that's to be continued, and we will continue when we come back for Ascension. But before we go, it's time to do the X quiz, because, you know, it may be a two-part episode, but there's still plenty in here to test you on, Darren. So are you ready for the five questions and a quote from Dwayne Barry?
I'm ready as I ever will be. Okay. Darren Mooney is ready.
Okay.
They're not going to catch Darren Mooney napping.
No. Darren Mooney is going to get this. So let's let's go for it. Question one. What's the name of the facility at the beginning where Dwayne abducts Dr. Hackey from?
I remember, because having done this quiz before, I made a point to note down as many legends as possible. That is the Davis Correctional Treatment Center.
Very good.
Which, yeah. I wondered, was that a nod to either Don Davis, the guy who played Scully's father, or William B. Davis?
Could be both. Quite possibly. Yeah. Question two. Yeah, well done. Off the grid. Question two. What gun is Dwayne armed with, according to Kasdan?
Smith & Wesson. I don't know the specific make of it.
I will give you that.
Sorry, the specific. Yay!
I'll give you that. It's a 9mm Smith & Wesson handgun. She's very
careful.
That's
the caliber of the bullet, isn't it?
Yeah, I assume so, yeah. Okay, question three. I think you'll get this, because you alluded to it earlier. Name the four hostage negotiation steps that Mulder is told to follow.
Okay, he is looking for... Damn it, I know where... Okay, so there's reconciliation. There is... Okay, I'm going to have to pass on that one, I'm afraid.
All right, I'll give you it. You're close. Honesty, containment, conciliation, resolution. So you're close. Question four. What does Agent Kasdan order, coffee-wise, for Krycek to go and get her. Now, you think you said this earlier as well.
Yeah, it's a percentage mocha, so I'm going to say... Oh, no, it's a 2% cappuccino with vanilla.
Yes, but grande. So she's in it for the long haul. Okay, question 5. What is the area of Dwayne Barry's brain that was shattered in his injury? This is what Scully says at one point when she's describing the piercing.
Okay, so he has got... It's some sort of cortex. Hold on. Oh, yeah, pass. I'm going to pass on that one.
Okay. It's the bilateral frontal lobes.
Damn it. Okay. Not having a good round today.
You've done okay. You got 3 out of 5. That's pretty good.
All right. So, and now the quote.
For the quote. Okay. Again, name the character and the scene, ideally. So, sometimes when you want to believe so badly, you end up looking too hard.
Sometimes when you want to believe so badly, you end up... That is Scully.
Yep.
That is after... She's sort of making him feel better after the whole Dwayne Barry situation. So it's immediately after the sort of pop star cut to black, lots of noise, lots of action sequence.
Yep, you got it. Well done. That's 4 out of 6. That's pretty good.
All right, I'll get there.
That's not bad. You'll get the six eventually. Maybe next episode. Who knows?
Who knows?
I'm an optimist. So that brings us to the end of Dwayne Barry. And for the first time, the X-Cast is to be continued. So Darren will be back for Ascension, which will be coming your way very, very soon. So we'll save all the goodbyes in the promotion until then, and we'll leave this on a massive big to be continued until we return for Ascension. Remember, just one thing, trust no one.